you're joining us for the first time, we've been going through just the latter half of the book of Acts. We've been titling it Jesus Goes Global, and we've been looking about how these people with absolutely no money and no funds and seamlessly no resources, just a small, tiny group of people, were able to share the good news of Jesus and create a cultural revolution that changed the entire world at that point. So, Acts chapter 18, I trust that this morning's message will be a blessing for you and be an encouragement for you today. I think it was an encouragement to me and spoke to my heart convictingly, and I hope it will this morning for you as well. So, just to recap, here's what we've been doing so far. Let me make sure that I get the map here. Here's what we've been doing so far. Just so you know, and follow along in the story, Paul, who's a missionary, has decided that he's going to go on a missions trip. And on that missions trip, his goal was to go to all the churches that he planted before and strengthen them and encourage them. And along the way, God gives him a vision and says, I don't want you to do that. I want you to go over to Greece. And I want you to tell people in Greece about Jesus. So that's what he does. And so far, he's been going through every city along the way. And he's been sharing Jesus. And in those cities, what's interesting so far is he's been met with average or little success when it comes to actually sharing the good news of Jesus. So there's been a response, not this massive response every time. Though today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a story where he saw the biggest response to Jesus so far, and he didn't have to get run out of town to do it. Not so far. And so I'm going to tell you a story, and then what I'd like to do is I'd like to pull out maybe a couple things that we can learn from that going forward. So very first thing, Acts chapter 18, verse 1, here's what you and I need to know. Paul leaves Athens. Remember, he was in Athens. He had that big ordeal with all those gods, and he comes before the Acropolis. Then what we know is that he leaves Athens, and he heads to a city called Corinth. And so I don't know if you can see it on the map. It's kind of like right, there's Athens right there, and so Corinth is just kind of right in this little area kind of here. That's important to understand, because here's what I'm going to tell you that you need to know about the city of Corinth. It is both, can you go back to the slide where it says epic? It is both epic and its sin is in overdrive. So you've got to understand something. It is both an epic city and a very dark city. I asked ChatGPT the other day, what a modern equivalent of the city of Corinth might be. Does anyone want to take a guess what city it spouted out?
Vegas.
Anyone else?
Los Angeles.
Close. Think worldwide. What's that?
Troshu.
Yes. it spit out Dubai. Right, you got to think about Dubai, and I thought that's weird, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was a good comparison, because here's the truth, is that Corinth was a nothing town. It was taken over by Rome, leveled by Rome, and then completely built brand new from scratch. Think of like Seattle. You know, you go to Seattle, like, I don't know if you've heard, there's like a city underneath the city, like, it's pretty cool. That's sort of what happened to Corinth. Corinth was like this bustling town like that. Every building in Corinth was less than 100 years old. It was a very modern city by the time that the story takes place. It gave meaning that it had this fresh Roman feel to it. The city's architecture, laws, and political structure was all Roman. Large parts of the population were Roman. The city was multicultural, attracting people from around the world. In its time, Corinth was the largest city in Greece in the province, with a population of 200,000 people. Now, that might not be big in our standards. Some of you are like, that's a big city. But that was massive then. And so is a big, important, massive city. And it is epic in every sense of the word. And the reason I want to say that it's epic is because of what it's famous for. Okay? If you know here, it's I want to show you this, and I want to explain this a little bit. If you were a sailor, and you were to sail around this kind of area right here, it was like a death sentence, right? So what sailors would do is they would sail in to that kind of inlet there, and you see where that white square is? That's where Corinth is. Here's what they would do. They were so scared of this area here that they would take their boats, okay, and they would take their boats, lift them on the shore, and drag them across the land to the other side, right? So you kind of see it there? That's what the road looks like today, what's left of it, okay? You want to know what they do today instead of this? That's just recently built, maybe about 100 years ago-ish, give or take. But before then, they would take the boats and they would drag them across the land like this across the city. So it became, here's why that's important to note for a story, it became a port city, a major port city. And with it became wealth, and and what started happening was this. People started shipping their goods to Corinth as a port city. So everyone was like, well, let's diversify the economy. And it became a manufacturing city as well. So all the manufacturing stuff gets done there. And then what ends up happening is it experiences this massive upsurge of wealth. It becomes like, and this is where kind of the Dubai analogy comes in. It just becomes extremely luxurious, extremely wealthy. It's the happening place to be. It's brand new. It's attracting everybody from everywhere. If you wanted it, Corinth had it, okay? If you were, Corinth offered everything, entertainment, sports, and culture. So if you were into UFC, it had UFC. The first gladiator fights that were held in Greece were held in Corinth. For sports enthusiasts, Corinth held the Isthmian Games. Remember what I talked about that when we were going through our Olympic series. It was second only to the Olympics in terms of its popularity. Both men and women competed in these games, including events like chariot races. And here's an interesting fact that you didn't know. Women would also compete in sort of the death, kind of like the war chariot races, right? Meaning this is that Corinth became a place for liberated women. So it's a very interesting city. If you wanted arts and culture, it had it. It had places for drama and Broadway and all these kind of things. It was just this epicness of the city, right? It's also a city on overdrive. It was very dark. The licentiousness in this town was next to none. Up to this point, it was the largest, wealthiest, and most morally corrupt city Paul had visited. Sexual immorality was rampant, with the city's most prominent deity being Venus, the Roman goddess of love. According to the myth, Venus was considered the sister of Julius Caesar, believe it or not. Corinth's temple was dedicated to Venus, and it housed over 1,000 temple prostitutes who daily left the temple to seduce people throughout the city. Corinth was extremely proud of its religious diversity. Every meal could be seen as a spiritual experience because every meal in the marketplace and the vendors was sold as seen as sacrifice to various gods. So when you read for 1st and the 2nd Corinthians, that's what's going on there. It's dark, man. It's gross. It's disgusting. It's like depraved in a way that you would not want to be there. It's the kind of city that makes you want to run from the city and move to Three Hills, okay? If you understand, it's that kind of city. So that's the setup to where Paul is at, and he's setting the good news of Jesus in this city. Well, the story goes on. It says that Paul splits his time between work and ministry. It says this in verse 2. When he went to the city, he found a Jew named Aquila and a native of Pontus who recently came from Italy with his wife Priscilla. So Priscilla and Aquila, they are mentioned 6 times in the entire New Testament. They become important secondary characters as you read through the story of the Bible. They were tent makers by trade, which was a new, unique career that allowed them to travel with Paul. So Paul meets up with them, and he starts making his living. He splits his time between working, doing his job, and then he goes and spends his weekends arguing like he normally does in every other city about Jesus in the synagogue. Remember how I said that he follows the same pattern in everywhere he goes? Starts with the Jewish people, goes into the Jewish synagogue, reasons from the Old Testament that Jesus is the Savior they're looking for, and then goes to the Gentiles. That's what he does. But here, so what he does is he spends half his time working, half his time doing that. But when Silas and Timothy arrive, he spends all his time sharing about Jesus. Listen to what it says in the text. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying with the Jews about Jesus Christ. And remember what we said happened to Paul and, or Silas and Timothy. Where was the last time we heard about these guys? Any takers? In the beginning? They were actually left, I believe, in Berea or Thessalonica, right? I think it was Berea, where Paul left them and established so that they could establish church. So they're still working up there, and then they meet Paul in Corinth. And what we know is that as soon as they arrive, Paul devotes their complete time to sharing the gospel. Silas and Timothy had completed planting churches and establishing leaders there, but here's what we know. We know that they took up an offering, like a monetary offering, from those churches so that Paul could devote his work full-time to the gospel. How do I know that? Because that's what it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 11 and 9. It says, Paul, when I was with you, while I was in need, I did not burden you, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. So he's saying, hey, these guys came down and they supplied all my needs. So I want to say observations for those of us who are in leadership, who are in ministry, or who are volunteering in some sort of way, in some capacity. What I want you to observe here is there is a season in Paul's life where his time was divided between fulfilling his calling, which was sharing the good news of Jesus, and supporting himself financially. But when help arrived, he was able to devote himself fully to the gospel that he was called to. And so there are two things that I think need to stick out for us just as a point of encouragement for us. Number one is I think there is a difference between making a living and fulfilling your calling, right? Is that what I'm trying to say is this, is that the way that you survive, the way your vocation, the way that you bring in money might not necessarily overlap with the calling that God has placed upon your life. There are two different things. Now, I think that sometimes they can overlap, in which sense that you can earn your living from your calling, but often that's just a season in your life. And I want you to point it out to us. So a good example of this would be, years ago, I applied to a church as an intern. And they went through a whole bunch of questions, and they asked, what's your calling? And I said, well, right now, I believe that God has called me to disciple youth and help them know Jesus and all that kind of thing. And then they said to me, Dan, what would you do if you didn't get the job here? Like, what would you do? Like, and I'm like, well, what do you mean? Well, if your calling is to share the good news of Jesus with youth, what would you do if we didn't pay you for it? Because it was an internship, right? Like, they don't pay. And you know what I told them? I said, this is what I do. I would go down there, find a local McDonald's, get hired at the McDonald's, make a living for myself, and then come to youth on Friday night and help out and volunteer. Right? Sometimes your calling and your vocation don't always mesh up. Sometimes they do, and it's very important. The second thing I want you to notice is that there are seasons when your ministry may be split between necessary tasks and your calling. During these times, it can be frustrating to do work that doesn't really align with your calling, but I want you to hold on, because in those times, I believe that just like Silas and Timothy were a help to Paul, help may come to you, so that there are seasons where you actually can fully dedicate yourself to what God has called you to do. And so I just want to point that out for some of us who are volunteering and leading this morning. Well, going on in the story, here's what happens. It's starting to sound like a broken record at this point. He shares the gospel in the synagogue, and the Jews oppose him. It says this is when they opposed him and reviled him. He shook his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own hands. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Right. So he's sharing Jesus with his Jewish friends. They're not having any of it. He says, "I'm done with you." And just so you know, when it says that, "Hey, I'm done with you," he's not saying that he's done with all Jews ever. What he's saying is, okay, I'm done with these Jews in these cities. Now I'm going to focus on the Corinthian Gentiles and Greeks. And so, as you see, the story just kind of takes a turn, is the same as it always been. Goes to a new city, shares the good news of Jesus with the Jews reject him, and by this time, what winds up happening in the story is that he gets run out of town. But this is where the story changes a little bit, is that the resistance to the gospel, here's where I want to focus our attention for the remainder of our time together. The resistance of the gospel led to a rapid acceptance of faith. Listen to what it says in the story. And after he did that, he left there and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household. And many, what does it say? And how many people came to faith? Many. Many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed, and they were baptized. I want you to see something. It's subtle, but what the text is telling you is that there is a massive, massive response to the good news of Jesus Christ. And I know it's a little tricky to find, but here's what I want you to see, is that if you cross-reference this, what you see is that the gospel has made inroads into Corinth very, very fast. If you go to where it says verse 8, Crispus, the ruler of synagogue, he is mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 14, right? Which says this, "I thank my God I baptized none of you except" who? Crispus and Gaius. So, what that's saying is that when he writes the book of 1 Corinthians, there's a group of believers there, but he's writing to talk about the incidents that happened in Acts chapter 18. Then he mentions someone else called Gaius. Well, who's Gaius? Well, we know who Gaius is from Romans chapter 16. Now, please don't, I might lose you in here, but the book of Romans, just quick fact, was written while Paul was in Corinth. Okay? So with that knowledge being said, listen to what it says here. "Gaius, who is a host with me into the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, and our brother Cordus greets you as well." Remember I talked about that at the beginning of the series, Romans chapter 16? Well, who's Gaius? Now I want you to notice that Gaius is a person that is hosting a church. And Erastus is the city treasurer. So we know right away that it seems like if you take these three verses, what we can infer is that the gospel has made significant and rapid ingrowth into the city of Corinth really fast. And I would make the observation that a full-grown revolution was happening in Corinth. People were accepting Jesus in large numbers, faster and in greater quantities than any other city that Paul had been in so far. Many Corinthians who heard Paul were believed and getting baptized, becoming followers of Jesus, okay? And here's why this is so important, just for those of us who might be a little bit of a Bible nerds. This is the background that you should read 1 and 2 Corinthians in. Because the rapid growth of the church brought on many challenges. In 1 Corinthians, Paul addresses the issues that had arisen. Factions had developed, people were being involved in immoral relationships, Christians were suing each other, some were getting drunk off communion, others were having debate about eating meat, sacrifice to idols, there were false teachers spreading, people were talking about speaking in tongues, and the church was splitting over spiritual gifts. It was, in fact, a messy church. But notice something when you read 1 and 2 Corinthians, Paul never called them false Christians, except for maybe one. He calls them immature Christians, and I want to make this point because this is often what happens when the church grows too quickly. People crowd in even when there isn't enough time to mature every new believer fully. And so you get all these issues in church, and it's not the kind of church that you would necessarily want to go to. But personally, I'd rather have the problem of a church of who is crowded with too many people than no one coming to church at all. So that's the story of gospel. So far, the gospel responds. People are responding in a way that they haven't seen before. And what we know is this is the first time Paul didn't have to run away. Look at verse 9. The Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you. No one will attack or harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people." There again is a reference to how many people are coming to faith in Jesus. And he spent a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. So this is the first time that he's been through Greece and a riot hasn't occurred that makes him run out, okay? So what that means is he has time to disciple, he has a time to rest, he has a time to write, and that's what he does. He spends time planning. Up until this point, this is how it's been going. You need Jesus, you need Jesus, you need Jesus. We don't like you. Big, violent, massive riot ensues, and he runs out of town. He literally has a week to tell the people about Jesus, plant a church, get the finances, and plant the elders. That's crazy. Could you imagine how we would run if we spent 1 week getting everything ready to church? That's crazy. And he would do it continually, time in and time out. But the church in Corinth, the believers in Corinth, was the first time he could stay and rest and develop and go on from there. Well, the peace doesn't last that long. What we know is the fast growth of the church caused a major backlash. Verse 12. When Galileo, the proconsul of Caia, made an united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, "This man has persuaded people to worship God contrary to the law." Now, the reference to the law there, that is not a reference to the state law, it's a reference to the Jewish law. Here's what it says. When Paul was about to open his mouth, Galileo said to the Jews, "If this matter were a matter of wrongdoing or a vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it's a matter of questions about words and names of your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to judge such things." And he drove them from the tribunal, and they all seized Scothinus, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But he paid no attention to any of this. After this, Paul stayed many days longer, and then took his leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria with Priscilla and Aquila. So that's the story. Goes to a very epic, dark city, shares Jesus, is rejected by his own people. That leads to a massive acceptance of Jesus by the Corinthian people that he's never seen before. He gets to stay for a while, but the fast growth leads to issues in the city. Here's the main observation that I would want us to take through for us so far. So far, in all the cities that we studied, the most responsive the people that have been the most responsible to Jesus also came from the most sinful city. I want you to note that. Their depravity knows no bounds. Port cities have a certain reputation. I should know. I come from them. They're exposed to diverse trades, new ideas, and booming populations. And they are often leading to widespread immorality. Corinth was a bustling, fast-growing city that embedded this reputation. When Liz and I first moved here, someone politely asked Liz where she grew up. And Liz said, "Oh, I grew up from Surrey." You know what the next response was? "Oh, you're a Surrey girl." Which that person meant well, but in our context is a very it's not a very nice term. It refers to someone with loose morals. I don't know if you know, make the note that Corinthians had something had a similar saying. In ancient times, Bible commentators note that to call someone a Corinthian girl meant that they had loose morals too. Corinth had a reputation of promiscuity. Anything in Corinth was extreme. It's a city where its sin is on overdrive, the depravity is unreal, and yet the best response to Jesus so far happens in the darkest city. So what would be the lesson that you and I would take for this? I'm going to give you three. Here's the first one. That there is no such thing as a lost cause. We should not assume that a licentious city or a licentious people is closed to the message of Jesus Christ. Let me say that again. We should never assume that the deeper sin, the more deep into sin people are, the less responsive they will be to Jesus. I don't necessarily think that's true. It's not necessarily true here, is it? Because he's been through city, through city, through city, and the depravity and the sin that he's encountering in Corinth is on another level, and yet the best response to Jesus happens here. Okay? We should never assume that the more deep in sin people are, the less, the more closed they are to Jesus Christ. And I think this speaks to all of us, especially those of us who've grown up in the church. We should never assume that they don't want a desire to know Jesus because we have seen a level of darkness in their lives. Many of us are too quick to look at the depravity in people's lives and assume that they're a lost cause. We even find ways to justify it from Scripture, don't we? Have you ever heard this saying, Matthew chapter 7, verse 6? Do not give holy what is to dogs. Do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample underfoot and turn them to attack you. We are meaning that you don't give something that is worthy to those that don't appreciate it. We're far too quick to pull that out when we see sin in our friends' lives. But in doing so, we risk giving up on the very people who may need the gospel the most. Here's what I want to say. Too often we run away from the darkest and most disgusting and the most depraved among us. And I think that rather than do that, we need to do what Paul did and run headlong in the darkness, not away from it. Remember what I told you at the beginning of the series, that you read Acts through Jesus' words, "I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." Meaning that we are to go and be on the offensive and go into that city of hell and tell people about Jesus Christ and rescue them from the darkest dungeons that exist there. Don't ever assume that the deeper people are in sin, that the less they desire to hear or are in need of Jesus Christ. We are too quick to run away from the darkest, the darkness, when we as Christians need to be running headlong into it. I think we need to be raising our kids while our kids are in the safety of our homes, away from all that kind of stuff. We need to be raising our families in such a way where we look at the depravity among us and send our families and our kids into it to share the good news of Jesus Christ with our friends. I once a church just like ours where most of the church families homeschooled their children. And so here's what they did, is they would send their kids on missions trips just like any other church would. But here's what they would do differently. Instead of sending their kids on missions trips to a different part of Canada or a different part of the States or Mexico or somewhere else, they would take these homeschool kids and do missions trips to Berkeley, okay? Where these tiny, these like 15, 16 year, 17 year kids, they would travel all the way from their safe, sheltered homeschool communities and go to the most liberal college and talk about Jesus with people who are more educated than them, more liberal than them, and share the good news of Jesus Christ. And you know what? There was response. I think we need to be a little bit more like that. That is why I think doing ministry in Pine Ridge is so important for us as a church. It's dangerous there. It's dark there. Right now, there are kids in your families that are grown up in safe environments in Ghost Pine and Three Hills who are running youth groups and kids ministries and putting their own physical safety at risk. Why? Because it's a dark place that needs Jesus. And we should not assume because it's dark or that there, or we see the licentiousness or the sin there or the partying there, that there isn't a need in those kids' lives to accept Jesus. Listen to me. I'm trying to tell anyone that's going to listen right now that this is our moment. That you and I were built for this. The Church of Jesus is built for the darkness. Like, the darker it gets, the nastier it looks, the more confusing it gets, that's our moment to go in and share the good news of Jesus. We can't run away from the depravity. We should run away from the depravity in terms of our own morality and our spiritual lives, but we should be running headlong into those places that are sinful and dark, and share the good news of Jesus with those people, because those people are not the enemy. They're the ones that need Jesus. So first one, never assume that there's such a thing as a lost cause. Never assume that the sin in people's lives means that they're not interested in hearing about Jesus. Number two, here's what I'm going to say. The Great Commission leads believers and churches to minister in urban areas. I want to be very careful with this, but I want to say very clearly that I'm not saying that we all have to live in the city, and I'm not saying that cities are better than small towns. I don't want any of that kind of discussion. I don't want any of that kind of divide. But what I'm going to suggest here is that both individuals and churches who care about the Great Commission must at least have some aspect or some care for what happens in urban ministry. I don't think it's possible for us to truly care about the Great Commission and avoid urban areas. One of my favorite theologians, a preacher, is a guy named Timothy Keller. He passed away not that long ago. I want you to hear what he has to say about this.
Cities, and talk about why cities are so important and so strategic.
Well, one of the reasons cities are so important for the world mission of the church is that they're growing. Mm. When Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples, he didn't mean go into all the world geographically. He didn't say, go to Antarctica and start churches, okay? Even though it's a big part of, you know, geography.
Yeah.
He meant go into the world demographically. He meant go to where the people are. And the people of the world are moving into cities faster than the church is. Mm. So if we don't spend a lot of effort to plant churches in the cities that are growing and growing and growing, then we are actually not obeying the Great Commission. So there's the one answer. National leaders everywhere in the world reach their biggest global cities, and they have problems. The house churches that proliferate all through China have trouble when they go into the big cities because the ministry needs are different. So just because a church is growing in a country doesn't mean it's reaching its biggest city, and that's what we try to do.
And I love the point you made in one of your sermons that it was on the book of Jonah, that Jonah was trying to run away from a city, right. And God actually said, no, that's exactly where you should go. When things get bad, God goes into a city. When things get bad, Christians usually leave the city.
Listen, friends, I think the gospel needs to go wherever there's lost people. So the gospel needs to happen here in Ghost Pine. It needs to happen in Three Hills. It needs to happen in the rural areas. But I think that Christians at large have largely given up in urban areas. When I think about cities today, it seems that the church's presence is gradually disappearing. That, like, the darker the cities become, the more Christians seem to be retreating, almost as if they've been given up believing that the gospel can make an impact in the darkest and most depraved areas. But Corinth tells us a different story. In Acts, here's what I want you to see. We see that the early church targets the major urban centers first. Yet, if you were to look at many North American models of evangelism today, churches don't do it instead. Most of them are starting to are pulling out. If you took a city like Vancouver or Calgary and you looked at the population density, where all the people are, you would find that the most amount of people are closer to the core. But then if you overlaid that with a map of the churches in the area, you would find out that the churches are not in the core, they are in the suburbs around. Now there's reasons for that. Some of it is practical and financial. But I believe that part of it is that we've just given up looking at the most darkest part of an area. And usually a downtown core of any city will be its densest, but it will also be its most depraved. I think about Vancouver and the East Hastings, or I think about Point Douglas and Winnipeg. I think that at some level, churches need, as they are sharing the gospel locally, as they are sharing the gospel internationally, there should be some aspect where we care about what happens in the core. Not that we need to move there, not that living there is better, none of this stuff, but just that we have a passion for lost people, and lost people live there. So that's where we should go. Lastly, and I'll make this point and then we'll go, is that we need to trust in God's protection and vindication while we are ministering in those dark areas. Two observations really quick. One is that God gave Paul a vision of protection. He said, stay here, I will protect you. And then when he was brought before Galileo, God actually used that person to protect Paul from being torn apart too. So I want you to see that it's very, very important for us to trust in God's protection and his vindication when we are in areas that are dangerous in sharing the good news of Jesus. That's where I'm going to leave you today. So as we go forward, he's going to sail to Antioch and Ephesians, but I think what I want to leave you with today is never assume someone is a lost cause just because you see sin in their life. Let's close with one more song.